Hello, you're listening to a spoiler-filled film conversation. Hooray!
Sneakers.
Sneakers. Pair of daps.
Daps. Fucking hell. I haven't heard that for ages.
I was actually trying to look for a pair of daps about a week ago because I needed new shoes for work.
When you
and
say it, you
daps
sound like
are...
it's a... When you say pair of daps, you make it sound like two stupid kids. I was looking for a pair of daps to come and do my fucking work around the house.
Pair of daps.
Oh, you pair of daps. Stop messing with that horse and get back in the house.
It's hard because daps always was. It seemed like an interchangeable term depending on who you were talking to.
Yeah.
It could mean slippers. It could mean trainers. It could mean, like, Converse.
Don't,
like,
don't lie. There's one thing we all know the daps are, and that's the shoes children wear for gymnastics.
Yes.
Those are daps.
Yeah.
Everyone accepts that. You don't get those later in life. Just
I've never seen them outside of that context.
Like, people wear Crocs when they're adults, and yet I've seen adult jelly shoes on people.
Yeah,
but no gymnasium daps.
I wanted them because they would have been perfect for work.
Do you do a lot of high wire work or a lot of work with a horse?
They insist that you have a black fart shoe
fart
in retail.
Shoe.
That's why I heard it as well.
Oh, smart.
Black,
yeah.
Black fart shoes.
You should do what they do in school, which is you buy, you know, black Adidas, and then Marlene Skits makes you pen over the white in Sharpie.
Oh God! Right, you're required to ruin these brand name shoes.
Yeah, because they're not black enough. Racist, that's what I say. Right, on point, guys. Hello, my name is Richard Nicholas. My passport is my voice. Verify.
Denied.
My voice is my passport. It might be. Oh, access
yeah,
not granted.
It is.
Welcome to the podcast, everybody. Also here, they didn't do robot voice, they just did badly spliced together voice. I'm doing it wrong now.
Yeah, you're getting more robot-y.
What you should do is take a little bit from all the other podcasts we've done and then splice them together now.
You used to have to do that anyway for the intros, so fucking symbolic. Couldn't even get out the name of the podcast without fucking it up. Right, yes, the other people on the podcast are Anthony.
Yeah, hello.
Abby.
Hello.
And Jamie.
Hello.
Yes, this week we are tackling the film Sneakers from 1992, and it was Abby's pick, so she will tell you the stellar cast and who done made it right now.
Sneakers is from 1992, directed and written by Phil Alden Robinson. It was also co-written by Lawrence Lasker and Walter F. Parks. It's about a group of older man hackers, average to a bunch of shit. We'll get into it.
You didn't even say that with any conviction. Bunch of fucking old man hackers. We'll get into it, yeah? Don't eat another plot of Sneakers. What you fucking want to know?
It stars Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, David Strathairn, Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix, Ben Kingsley, Donald Logue, Timothy Busfeld, and Eddie Jones.
James Earl Jones, too.
James Earl Jones.
Mm-hmm. And Mary MacDonald.
That's the lot.
And another decent turn by Stephen Tobolowsky, who always...
Yeah, Stephen Tobolowsky.
Yeah.
Also, before I forget, there is another connection to my favourite things in here. On the Twin Peaks box of the bingo card is Gary Hirschberger, who plays the young version of Robert Redford's character at the start of the film.
With a terrible Hulk Hogan moustache.
Yes, awful, awful fake moustache. Yeah, he was Mike in Twin Peaks in both the old series and movie and briefly in the newer one as well.
Ooh. Any trivia about the other young man playing young Ben Kingsley? No, he's not
in anything I like. He's not in Mad Max or The Exorcist or Twin Peaks. I don't care.
Okay. Abby, you picked Sneakers.
Yes.
Why?
There was two-prong reason. First prong, I felt like doing something that involved blind people. I don't know where it came from. I just thought.
You felt like doing something with blind people? What, like reading them a book? Like what? Explaining art to them that they can't see? What did you want to do with blind people?
The second fork was I felt like it was time for me to throw my childhood under the bus again.
Here at Spoilerfield, we hate our childhood selves, and we love buses. We just can't get enough of flattening our childhoods under that bus. So this is what, a child... This isn't really a kid's movie, though, is it? I mean, it's borderline. But
I think this is a very good explanation for why I'm the kind of person that I am. Because while you were watching stuff like The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars, I was watching stuff like Sneakers.
Was this film your dad's favourite film? Because it feels like one of those. Like, not yours specifically, somebody's dad's favourite film, particularly in the 90s.
I always watched it with Ollie, so it might have been Ollie's favourite film.
When you say always, does that mean you've watched it multiple times?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh.
I liked it as well, but I'm still, like, exasperated by the idea of watching it more than once.
I think it's, like, the schlubby man's Ocean's 11, isn't it, really? It's like...
Yeah, you're right. That's what I mean. It's somebody's 90s dad's favourite film.
And then Ocean's came out and it kind of changed the game on what's exciting.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I had, was... It's a similar thing, like, so many films have done it better since.
Yeah.
But it's hard for me to kind of grasp it in the bubble of its time. If you think about it, this was before, you know, what was the thing you said? Ocean's 11, it was before, had elements of Mission Impossible to it as well. Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. Mission Impossible came out a couple of years later, or a few, like, 96 was Mission Impossible. And there's some similarity between them. There's a tonal similarity. I mean, this is more, you know, this is a softer film than that first Mission Impossible is, but it's got a lot of that 90s exposition-y kind of thing going on. But it's more kind of laid back many times to a fault.
Yeah, this was a lot goofier than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. I was glad of that at times.
Yes.
Like, if it had been more serious, it would have been very hard to sit through the whole thing.
I feel like a lot of that came from just, like, improvising, if you know what I mean. Because got this, like, you do have a fab cast in this.
The cast saved it for me.
I feel like they probably just took it and ran and had some fun with it.
Yeah, like, but if you compare it to something similar like Hackers, Hackers is like cool, we're fucking gonna rollerblade and have shitty nicknames. Well, they actually, both of these films have shitty nicknames. But, this is the middle-aged, cool dad version of Hackers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did anyone else feel like Robert Redford and Sidney Poitier were just that little bit too old to be believable in these roles?
Sidney Poitier playing I'm ex-CIA or whatever, that's okay. He should be older. He's in a different, you know, he's in a different business now and stuff. He's your older guy. But Robert Redford, he's sort of got a love interest, and you just look at Robert Redford and go, why are there so many crow's feet on your face, even where they're not normally are?
Exceptionally leathery. Like, even back in the early 90s, the weird thing about Robert Redford is, and I think I always get this from him, whenever I think of him in any, like, his name comes up and I imagine him, I imagine a very, no, I know what he looks like, but he always has this, like, stoic thing going on. Yeah. But then whenever I see him in a film, he's always this cheeky fucker. Like, sure. He's just got this look on his face of, like, oh, he's a boy. Like, he's going to cause trouble. Like, he's got this youthful thing going on, but his face looks like it's dehydrated. Like,
I don't want to sound like a mean casting director, but is he past it for this role? You know?
I don't... I mean, I think that's... almost the point. That's what I mean. It's the movie for dads, which, you know, I say as a a dad in his 30s, but, you know, I think a dad in 2018 is very different from a dad in the early 90s, and this is very much, you know, high-waisted, light blue jeans that Robert Redford's wearing kind of thing.
So, Abby, did this... When you remember it fondly, and then, you know, were you checking up on your nostalgia for it, or what? Was it like, oh, I'm going to relive the joy of Sneakers, but you weren't sure if it was going to be that way, or what?
Not sure how I got there, but it occurred to me that I haven't seen Sneakers since my mum got a flat screen TV.
Okay.
And I mean, it was like,
that is a very personal way to date it. I mean, people don't really know, did your mum get round to it really quick, or did she take her time?
I was going to say, it's like, oh, well, my parents got a flat screen TV basically as soon as they came out, because they liked their TVs so big, and before flat screen, that meant they had to be crazy deep as well. We were getting into, like, TVs that were basically the size of a small motorcycle.
I'll say that Sneakers, if people sometimes buy, like, edgeless, huge, curved, fancy TVs for, like, new movies, I think a big, fat, deep, big TV is what you should watch Sneakers on. Like, the appropriate type, like a really fancy 90s TV that's heavy.
We've got, like, a pretty big but normal HD TV. Like, it's not 4K, but it's 1080. But after I finished this film, I felt like I'd watched it on a CRT box. It exudes that 90s feel.
Yes, it's definitely very, very fucking AOL, isn't it?
The whole thing. It felt, at times, it felt like a particularly complex episode of Baywatch.
Wow, okay, like, I don't know what you're on about now.
No, I mean, like, it had that TV movie tone. You know, when, back at this time of the 90s, you'd be watching ITV in the afternoon, and you sort of half start watching an episode of something, and then realize
you're not fucking Baywatch, though. Like, what are you on about? There's no Pamela Anderson running down a beach, but also hacking a PC.
Okay, 90s era Columbo. Then that kind of
was Columbo. Is this still making Columbo in the 90s?
Yeah,
they brought it back.
Oh, mate.
But it has that feel of, you accidentally watch a bit of it on Saturday and then realise you've been watching it for 4 hours and you don't really know what's happening. Like, that's kind of what happened to me when I watched it yesterday on a Saturday afternoon, appropriately enough.
I mean, it feels 4 hours, but it is a slim 2 hours and something or other. It's change.
2 hours and 2 minutes, and it's almost like that 2 minutes just pushes it over the edge.
And it's not like we get to know the people either. It's quite a team, and yet they have nicknames and small backstories.
But I mean, we don't delve into their past, but we do get a good sense of their relationships with each other and their
mad banter.
This is... Okay, so this was the strength of the film, I think, for me, was the main cast of the, whatever you want to call them, the hackers. River Phoenix.
The sneakers, surely. Do they sneak about? They don't do a lot of sneaking.
They
loudly drive through a car park with a blind man and they shout and they dive through ceilings.
I can't help but feel that there's a scene later on where they literally have Robert Redford walking incredibly slowly because the name of the film was called Sneakers.
But yeah, you have a really good cast. Sidney Poitier and Robert Redford's relationship as these two older men, it's very easy to buy. It feels like they've known each other for a long time. You've got Dan Aykroyd is really entertaining, basically just playing himself.
Conspiracy maniac.
Insane conspiracy theorist, but oddly charming in a really bizarre kind of way.
The main problem with Dan Aykroyd in this character is he is obnoxiously referred to as mother. And it's a little, nicknamey bullshit.
Yeah, sure.
They all call him mother. And I think I know why, but I don't know. Can anyone explain why he's called mother by the group of dudes?
There must be a reason for it, because there's a lot of really small details in this film that can go by
It's because not like it's hard. He doesn't mother them, and he doesn't wear like an apron or something. Or pet, like, what is it? Just because? Like, do mothers come up with conspiracy theories? Like, why do they? Is it just a fucking wanky? Oh, it's so contrary to what a good nickname would be. It's a great nickname. Like, I don't get it. Why is he called mother?
An inference could be made. It's because mother was always the one who was dealing with the phone lines and stuff. And when Kreese rang up, was trying to get Bishop's attention, he was saying, it's your mother. So I just think quite often he gets called mother as a distraction or as like a safe word.
An excuse or, yeah.
There's some sort of credibility to what you're suggesting. But, oh, fuck off with that nickname. What's
but
the name?
Still.
Yeah. And then the deaf guy, what's he called?
Whistler.
Because he listens to noises and he's good at... How does hacking with
he's
your ears
blind,
work?
Blind, Rich!
Oh, yeah. He's not deaf. He couldn't hear anything. I'm sorry to my hearing... if you're a hearing impaired... You're not listening, and I haven't offended you. If you can't see, I am no. So you're right. He is blind, and he does all his hacking with his ears. How does that work?
He's got that cool little braille tournament. No, terminal.
He's got a braille terminal.
The moving braille. Yeah.
But what? What's
yeah,
that?
That was awesome.
But like, he listens to beeps to know if the beep changes. That tells him that that's the beep to. Put through the computer and like what?
Remember how dial-up had a sound?
Yeah,
that's what he's listening to.
Well, you can hack dial-up if you like. Oh, that's the tone of dial-up. I need to. And then what do you do? Like what? How
it
did any of it
different.
Work?
Different. Did you ever pick up the phone when someone was using a fax?
Yeah,
because it sounds different.
I know they sound weird, but how is that of any help to you?
Well, you know if someone's using the line or not.
Oh, so you get your mouth organ and you put a bit of paper in front of it and you play that down the telephone and you got free calls for life. How does
it
how
was
does
a
listening
series of beeps you get free calls for life and you know it.
Look, I don't understand how listening to computer noises is then.
Well, that's not all he does though. He listens to a ton of like he's clearly been blind forever and has
that's his world.
Yeah. So
yeah, but of what use is hearing things? Like
of what use?
It
is
shows you.
Things?
It only shows you
as a film. Well, yeah, but it doesn't make sense. Like he reads by braille, and okay, he's pretty. There's a lot of code and messages that come up, but he could easily make sense of it because he's a fucking whiz. That's fine. And but how is okay, so he's attuned to noises and subtleties and tone changes. But once you know there's a subtlety, what do you punch into your keyboard to once you've heard the noise?
To be fair, most of his kind of blind stuff is not computer related.
Yeah, it's more he thinks differently to them, which makes it essential. Like the one scene that like demonstrates how he's useful to them is the fact that when that scientist with the gross hair is making out with that woman in his office, and then they're trying to literally look for something on the screen, but because he can't, he's listening to what the scientist is saying, which is like gives them a clue that they're not picking up on because they're too busy trying to look for it.
I guess like also that's... his skill is also to do with because he's in tune to the subtleties of noise, he's more able to pick up on what you're supposed to listen to for electronic devices like cameras and beams and things. So and that's the thing, they're not just hackers, that's the thing, isn't it? They're a sort of crack, like they're not like they sort of
they're like spies, they're like not amateur but
like surveillance spies for security. Hire. Experts. And we'll talk about each of the characters. We talked about I want to call him Whoopsie. What's it? Whistler. Whistler is a blind guy whose expertise is noise and having cool glasses to have screens projected onto with all the code for the film.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he's a chap. He's got that going on. He's defined by his disability.
Yeah, pretty much, actually.
But, you know, rewind to the start of the film. young Robert Redford, who's one of our sort of leader of the group, isn't he? And he his backstory is him when he was younger, him and his like friend are I don't know what building they're in. They're like late night hacking into various things, like they're fucking hacking into Nixon's account and various big name businesses.
They're being naughty boys with computers in the '60s.
Robert Redford's job is to be smug and suggest who should pay into what thing, ironically. And the other guy, young Ben Kingsley, his job to do the hard stuff and be like, ooh, no, I haven't got any creative intuition. What should I do?
Yeah, and then Marty, Robert Redford's character, goes out for pizza and the police raid the place and only arrest Cosmo, and Marty fucks off to Canada.
He orders pepperoni shaken, not stirred. Lol.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's nice. Everyone who's seen a film before knows that the bad guy is going to be his friend who isn't dead in jail.
Oh, yeah. As soon as they say he died in prison, there's your villain.
Yeah.
But I will say, I liked the use of the different ratio for the 60s intro, and then the way it panned out from a small CRT screen into widescreen was some really like creative direction. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be a lot of other creative direction in the film, which I think
also
was part of my problem.
If you download the film, you think, what kind of Muppet recorded this? This is terrible. I thought I said it was HD. What's going on?
Yeah, I was watching it on Amazon Prime, and it started like that, and then I actually like checked the settings because I thought, oh, fuck, is this like some shit SD VHS rip?
The aspect ratio has got to be off on this. What's going on? Yeah, okay.
And then I was like, oh no, this is a creative choice, and I'm just a fucking idiot.
I kind of like the opening titles as well, where they have like the anagrams.
Yeah, I know that was a nice touch.
It was a nice start, actually. It had some like nice flair, some directorial flair, which it unfortunately didn't quite keep up with the rest of it.
Yeah, not to get too far ahead, but generally my problem with it was there was a lot of, it was a film of parts that never feel like they add up to something satisfying. Like, the plot makes sense, but
does it though?
For itself, but it doesn't, like, it there's enough that
the concept, the key idea of the what's happening to the people is fine. The what is going on, why and how it happens is a bit questionable.
It's just, well, it's more that it's it just gets dull. Like, it's not paced as well as it could be. There are a lot of moments that in isolation are entertaining, but as a whole, I had to pause it a few times and go and do something else and come back to it, because I was like, I'm struggling to pay attention to this.
Well, before we, that's kind of a blanket review for it all, so let's talk about some of the characters a bit further first. So Robert Redford, he's got that little history. He's now running a... Do they have a name as... The Sneakers, what's the... Do they have a company name or something? Sneaky Sneaksters.
I don't know if they do, but I feel like they should. Or did I miss it?
Might be dull. But we won't do any fact-checking. We'll just carry on. But, like, so Robert Redford runs a business that we see the demonstration of what they do via them seeming to rob a bank. Like, they have a little, it's like partly a con, partly, like, I don't know what term to use, because they're sort of hackers, they sort of work with surveillance and cracking thick calls.
Yeah, they're hired to test the security of the bank by faking a break-in.
Yeah, and so we get that break-in. It looks like Robert Redford has successfully got his team to hack in and basically set himself up with an account that he can draw like $100,000 from. He does so, and then he swaps that payload for a check from the company, which a really rude bank teller goes, looks like you don't get paid very much, you fucking twat. You got $100 million, and the bank is paying you pittance. But they can obviously afford a lavish, large apartment office thing.
Yeah, that open plan apartment is quite something.
Like brickwork, but nice not... and cool, and then loads of gadgety shit everywhere, and then a special see-through room.
But they can't afford a holiday or a car.
Well, they could afford a lavish party as well. They had like a party scene with like balloons. And...
Yeah, it was only them though.
Well... I would like to point out that they all work in an industry where they can get stuff and not necessarily pay for it.
Oh, that's true.
Hmm. Maybe.
It suggested early on. Well, it told us outright that the characters have all had a past where they've either committed crimes or crossed grey areas.
Yeah, they're all former something for one reason or another.
Yeah. But so the rest of the team, we kind of mentioned Whistler. Or I just thought of Whistler's mum, the painting, and I got confused.
Yeah, and I don't know why.
I wanted to meet Whistler's mum so we could have that reference completed, but we don't. But instead we have Mother, a separate character. So Mother...
Unless that is a reference to Whistler, Mother...
Yeah, have they been friends for a long time and he's the person who sort of helps Whistler if he needs it? With
this feels like a code that needs cracking all of its own. I don't think we've been able to do it without the bloody machine.
Yeah,
the best we can get is that scene in the Bean movie where he accidentally smudges the face and has to replace it with a cartoon, and that's the closest link I can get. I don't know.
That's us reviewing every film we've done.
But so you know, Mother is yeah, like you, I think Jamie, you said it. It was like Dan Aykroyd playing himself if he could just do hacking. Yeah, just complete. Like his thing is he's got loads of weird conspiracy theories that he tells to what's the name of
Kreese.
Yeah,
Sidney Kreese. Or like Batty Kreese.
That is weird.
Just literally his name is Kreese. It's not a nickname, is it?
No, Carl Kreese?
Donald.
Oh, is it Donald?
Well, then Carl is a different character again.
Yeah, Carl was
Carl's River Phoenix.
River Phoenix is Carl. So yeah, okay, so Mother, Dan Aykroyd, you know, schlubby, kind of crazy guy who, you know, he's talented, but he's a nut job, but maybe he's not, maybe he's onto something. So he's Dan Aykroyd light, or clever, I don't know. And then we got, so Kreese is ex-CIA guy, Sidney Poitier does a nice job of being a grumpy curmudgeon while similar, like the best scene with him in, and this is the part I really enjoyed, when they're surveilling like a couple having sex to do with
Oh, yeah.
There's a box, there's a thing. But like a scientist and his mistress or whatever, or it's not a mistress, is it? They kind of make that up. There's some people aggressively making out, and then Robert Redford's watching it with his special camera, and it sounds it sounds sexy, you know, on the old on the speakers. And so Phoenix is like, straight up, I want to fucking have a look. And then Sidney Poitier's like, don't be so fucking childish, get away. And he's like, let me see. And it gets a bit milder. And they sort of carry on with work, and he's sort of like...
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, the film is overall was pretty dull, but it has a lot of nice little comedy moments between the main characters that all feels natural. There's actually a quote from Stephen Tobolowsky where he says that this was one of the most fun films he made, like just the making of it, he enjoyed it a lot. Get the sense that everybody felt that.
Yeah,
like
that, it I feels see like
yeah, I got
everyone's
that
enjoying themselves.
But then we say there's good bits in it, and then there's bad bits of comedy where like at some point they have to buy some information from like they just need one of those big printouts of information, blueprints, blah blah blah, doesn't really matter. And then Phoenix has gone to get them, and he's like, oh, I just paid someone $20 for it. And Robert Redford's like, where'd you get the money from? And it's like, oh, I just got it from Mother's wallet. And then it's like, oh, that's okay. And I'm like, oh, fucking
the scene where he's trying to get the box, and then the woman walks in on him, and they're telling him the stuff to say, and it's just like,
oh my god,
that could have been so funny, and yet it was just lame.
It was just lame, like all the draw, and then the scene where Robert Redford is caught like snooping essentially, and has to lie to this woman that they've been watching fondle the book from Gotham for some reason. I mean, you've been watching a lot of Gotham. Were you like, oh, that guy, when you saw like the special scientist who's come up with a special cordy, like it's a box that can crack cords really well. but not like the
one
from...
Well, I said it the other way round, where I laid eyes on him and then went, this is what the first episode of Gotham I watched. I went, where do I know you from? And I've not been able to line it up this whole time.
That really is an interesting idea, that you're recognizing people from Sneakers rather than watching Sneakers. Yeah. And I've seen all of these people in other things. Like, no, Sneakers is the hub for where I recognize actors.
Oh, that's bloody... Oh, that's that Harvey Bullock is the guy from Sneakers who got killed and is a genius. It's also a bloke from Sons of Anarchy. Oh, bloody hell.
That guy who Bill Murray hates in Groundhog Day, he's from Sneakers.
But, I'll get a bit sidetracked here. The point, so who's left? We got, and then Carl, played by River Phoenix, young guy. That's his character.
Yeah. He's basically there to remind me how sad I am that River Phoenix died as young as he did, because he's always just entertaining and everything. He had so much energy and charisma. Yeah. I feel like had he lived, he and like cleaned up, he would be a big deal now. Sort of, he'd have gone on to be a major leading actor.
You have to associate yourself with Joaquin. That's the one you have to deal with.
Yeah,
he's got some good stuff.
I mean, no, I have no problem with Joaquin Phoenix.
You're right, Jimmy. It's sad when people are dead. It's sad that people can't keep working,
especially famous people.
It's more. I was hurt more by the death of James Dean that happened before I was born than the death of my own grandfather. It's terrible. I don't re-watch films with my granddad. there aren't any. I wish my granddad was in films now. Love you, Gramps. Anyway, he's dead and didn't hear that, and I don't know why I'm doing it. The point is this. River Phoenix's character is summed up by he hacked into his school computer to change his grades. Robert Redford and the gang stopped that and then employed him. And
stop that.
Don't do that. That's bad. Come work for us as we sort of commit crimes legally.
And do it all the time.
Yeah. You don't need grades where you're going to jail. But like they hire it. So that's the dream team, you know. Black guy, blind guy, young guy, stupid
Wait,
guy.
Wait, you're making it sound like
old guy. Old guy.
Yeah, there's two old guys. Robert Redford is, you know, just lead guy, I guess, I suppose.
Yeah, handsome older man with a mischievous glint in his eye.
Yeah, twinkle in the eye guy. But they're a team of dudes and they do work. And they're early on in the film, they're approached by Superman's dad and a guy with a ginger mustache. That's how I make my references happy.
Wait, Superman's dad, Marlon Brando?
No, Superman in
Clark TV
Lois,
Superman.
Lois
and Clark.
Yes! Thank you. Oh, that would be bothering me since I watched the film where that guy was from. Thank you. Lois and Clark.
He was Dean Cain's dad. Yeah, but like they approach the team and are like, we know all about you, except you, Robert Redford, or Bishop, as he's called. Our file is empty. Look at it, it's empty. No, seriously, here's a picture of you on the wanted list. We know who you are. I don't know why we pretended we didn't know. That's the reason you're going to work for us. We know that you're a criminal. Ha ha.
I think they were being cryptic about the idea that either he has deleted that past or they're showing that they can, you know, we can make this happen.
Yeah, it's a nice way to establish the baddies as underhanded and to make us root for our guys and so forth. So I don't begrudge it. It was a little bit, you know, silly, but it was fine. I wasn't...
About to say hacky and then thought better of it?
I think my brain wouldn't allow me to use the word. It's a bit hacky, but, you know, it's a bit cheesy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing. And then Robert Redford's like, listen, guys, you don't know anything about me, but here's my past. I'm going to be in trouble. You better all work for me. And they're all like, fuck off. We're all going to get in jail or killed for this stuff. But there's money. Moral comedy. They all turn around and go, we're in. money. Cha-ching.
I love that now it doesn't sound like a lot of money either.
No, it doesn't.
How much was it?
They have to share $175,000.
Oh wow, that isn't that much. I didn't even think about it when I was watching it, because like I always like whenever someone says more money than about 500, my eyes glaze over and my brain just goes, "That's lots."
I think I'd just be like, what amount of money does it take for me to work for someone who's blackmailing someone and is clearly in a position to get us all arrested and could betray us at any point? I'd just be like, I don't know, Rob. Bish. You're going to have to do this one on your own or go on the run to Canada again, because that isn't enough money, really. Although, but this is, we're talking about a team of people whose aspirational dreams are like, I want a camper van. I want to go around Europe on holiday. I want love and peace and world peace and stuff. I just want a girlfriend. Like, literally, we establish their life goals are to have basic things that people in any circle could achieve.
I mean, technically, they are nerds, I guess. And early 90s nerds was a, you know, that was a pariah label on you.
So what?
You and can't... it's all set up. For that like last scene,
it's such a tedious bit, isn't it?
Like, and it really is as well.
I was like, exasperated as he was.
Yeah, you're right.
Go on, Anthony, if you want to talk about it.
Oh, like yeah, all that is just set up for like the end where you know, they've saved the day, they've got the box, but James Earl Jones, NSA kind of agent, turns up and is like, "Oh, we'll have the box back, please." But they're like, "Oh no, we want all the things we said earlier on." And James Earl Jones is being exasperated.
Yeah, when that was happening, my thought was, I get it. You don't have to go through everyone.
Yeah, and at this point, you know, it's already been 2 hours of the film.
Yeah.
And it's already been at least 20 minutes too long. And you're just like, okay, we get it. After the first person asked for something, after the Winnebago joke, that was okay.
I did quite like James Earl Jones sternly telling him that Tahiti is not in Europe.
Yeah, that was a good bit. But like we have just the obnoxious like River Phoenix trying to get a phone number off one of the sexy FBI men. It's just Jesus.
This is the biggest problem probably of the film is that it drags. Like, a lot of it is just like, hurry up, come on.
But it's like, it's meant to be funny and entertaining you, but I just found it to be like, Whistler asks for world peace and James Earl Jones is like, I can't even, what world peace? This guy's taking the piss. And it's like, how do you even placate that? Or fucking, yeah, like, can't you just ask for like front row tickets to the Knicks or something? Like, what? Like, be real. Like, they just, it's such a, just shoot everyone and take the damn box at that point.
Yeah, that's,
for fuck's sake, like. But, yeah, there's a lot of faffing, but it's meant to be entertaining, right? I mean, Abby, did you find some of this stuff entertaining? Did it drag for you, Abby? Because it's your pick, after all.
I wouldn't say drag, but I would say it was a bit slack. That is my main problem with it, is just it was just a bit too slack.
Yeah, and I think the tension that it goes for in certain scenes, and also the comedy in other scenes, both of those would work better if it was tighter.
There's no sense of tension, because it doesn't, any of the times where it's life-threatening, it feels like they'll just laugh it off, because it's been a comedy a bit.
Mm.
And then the comedy is occasionally abandoned so they can be gripping and thrills, and there's like guns and hiding and espionage, and it's like, yeah, but we know you're just going to fart it off at the end. You know, there's no real sense.
Yeah.
So that kind of bothered me.
It doesn't... The stakes thing is a good point. Like, it doesn't feel like there are stakes. You've just been told there are.
Yeah, that is a problem. But let's talk a bit more about some of the capers, because they are interesting. We touched on the... you know, they set up Harvey Bullock from Gotham being a long-haired, fast-talking genius. He's got a board with equations on. He's got a box that can crack any code, apparently.
I just want to give one tiny little shout-out to him completely wearing white.
Yeah.
He looks like a tool, and I think he's kind of going for, I'm a nerd. And if you look like a tool, you're plausibly intelligent, I think is the shorthand, isn't it? But he's sexy like, to a woman, so that's nice.
He looks like a cross between Randy Quaid in Freaked and Viggo the Carpathian from Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah,
what a gruesome combination.
But he's
a gruesome combination of monsters.
You know, he's only in it for like a cup of coffee, really. Like he's murdered and gone quickly enough off screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a genius because he's come up with the best thing ever. That like it's the box essentially. Like they do keep calling it a box because we're all too thick to understand what it is, or it's so complicated. It's basically a microchip that can fucking figure out whatever it wants. Yeah,
yeah.
When they demonstrate it, they get like. Phoenix gets his little notebook of numbers for, I don't know, email addresses for, no, website names? Like, what does he
tell? Well, it's all of the different things that they have or have been able to, like, poke into in the past. And they're essentially testing the capabilities of what this thing is and can do.
But there's a little notebook with numbers on they put in the fucking email address of the I don't know, what do they do? Like, they do the banks and airports and things. And
it is a list of sort of, like, hacker holy grails. The stuff that's really heavily encrypted, and if you can get into them, then you're fucking elite.
And then the box has the googly-garbled code come up. And then, of course, get the blind guy to be operating the computer at this point. There's actually the whole film, and it's not just the blind guy thing. All the time, there's like three stages of doing something. So, like, Anthony's example was a good point. We got Robert Redford's in a room. You got someone feeding him lines. Someone else, like, is one person comes up with the lines. They tell it to the guy with the microphone. The guy with the microphone says it. Robert Redford hears it and says the line. And then they come up with the next line to say it. It's like, well, there's always three fucking people doing the, like, one person's job. Get Robert Redford to ablid. So, like, why? I'm in a room. There's a woman who snuck into me. I don't need to be mic'd up to be say anything. I could just go, hello, I am the cleaner. Goodbye. Like, why is this? Are they making it so hard with their little relays and comedy banter about fucking, I don't know, blowjobs or whatever it was?
Oh, also about that scene, I forgot about how much they milked the joke about opening the door.
Oh, God. I mean, it was really, like, cringy, that shit.
It really was.
There was some dads wearing their slippers and socks really having a hoot laughing at this.
That's it, yeah, that's exactly what I pictured whenever he kicked the door in and the build up with him, you know, listening to instructions and then it's he just kicks the door in and
yeah.
I could see somebody's dad going, "Oh, that's clever, isn't it?"
Yeah.
But it was so obvious, like as soon as, what's
the
deal with this? You know, he's just going to kick it in, isn't he?
That's what slows the film down, is that the humour that's there, what works is usually, well, it's all telegraphed. It's all really, really broadly telegraphed. So it's like the film wastes time leading up to a joke that you know is coming.
Yeah.
And it's not that the joke is inherently unfunny. It's just, yeah, I know. But it would be funnier if you did it. Part of what makes something funny is the surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
The problem with it with me was if you just had Robert Redford there for about 30 seconds going, mm-hmm, oh, yeah, mm-hmm, I see.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm, yeah, hmm, ha-ha, oh, hmm, oh, okay, I'll try that. But it's like, if it was just like, oh, I've got an idea, oh, okay, smash, that would have been funny.
The idea of him, like, listening to instructions and then it turns out it's something as simple as just kicking it is what they're telling him is fine, but he listens for too long. Like,
yeah.
if he just, for a couple of seconds, just went, uh-huh, okay, and then kicked it.
Like, yeah, exactly.
The joke that works in a different film is in Gone in 60 Seconds, one of the car feeds is like, I'm just going to use my tool, and the guy throws a brick through a window to rob a car, and it's like, that works. It was like 2 second joke. He referred to a brick as a tool. Ha ha ha. We've moved on.
Another really good example of it is Raiders of the Lost Ark. Whenever that guy has his sword in the middle of the marketplace, and Indiana's fought off all these guys, and then the guy with the giant sword does all the, like, swinging it around and all the tricks, and then Indiana just sort of looks annoyed, pulls his gun and shoots him, and then that's it. It's it happens in a couple of seconds and then it moves on. Yeah. And it's that speed and surprise that is what makes it funny. And I feel bad that I'm just explaining how jokes work.
How to do a good like, joke.
Yeah.
Here's some example. No, but like the another example from Sneakers of a time where they maybe take too long to do something that's meant to be funny and it doesn't work for that reason is so when Phoenix is hiding up in a roof space and Robert Redford's doing his. He's been caught really slowly nicking something, Mission Impossible style. And yeah. He's like talking. Like he's gonna. Robert Redford's basically gonna be shot. And there's like, oh, the fucking tedious Ben Kingsley joke of, I said I could never kill my friend. You yeah. guys kill my friend. Yeah, but then Robert Redford's like, now! And then there's nothing, and it's like, and the guy's like, now, yeah, now we're going to shoot you now, aren't we? We're going to shoot you now.
Yeah,
like,
see
that? And then it's like, now! And then eventually, Robert Phoenix then jumps down through this roof, and he's on top of him, and they're going to wrestle free. You know, that, it's like, oh my, I think it's just that dad joke mentality the whole film is. Like,
yeah,
just,
and it's
when your dad's got a joke and he's going to tell it to you and you just, oh, you
that
know,
scene is,
you know where it's
that
going
scene's
and you can't be bothered.
It's, even the fact that he says, you know, I can't kill my friend, and then he says to the guy, kill my friend. And then they just stand there just laughing and pointing guns at him. It's like, fuck's sake! Couldn't do it. Just do it.
Oh, let's discuss the main heist they have to do, and then I guess because it's essentially one big heist, isn't it? Like, there's a few other ones. They're all kind of there's a bit of foreplay heist. There's other little things, but there's one main scam after they get the special corded box that turns any like a cord like magically goes and it. You can access and control whatever
yeah,
you want.
It's a magic box.
The magic box that every government in the world would happily kill us for. They have that. They know that there's something suspicious, and there's like they're gonna you know they should be handing it over, getting paid, and not going to jail and all this. But they're on to these naughty men, and they pull out and they're kind of on the run, I guess. And they how do they get from being on the run to working being like Robert Redford's caught. By Ben Kingsley's crew, is that right? Does anyone want to talk us through a bit of this stuff?
Ben Kingsley turns up as Cosmo from the start, so in a shocking twist, he didn't die in prison. And in an even more shocking twist, Ben Kingsley is really bad at doing an American accent.
Yeah.
What the fuck was he... Like, what is he going for?
And why did he have a little... He had a little draw handle on the back of his head.
The fucking grotesque early 90s villainous ponytail.
Maybe his head doubles up as, like, a Toby jug, and that's just a hand twist.
He actually... Fuck, you're right. He does look like a Toby jug.
I mean, Abby, do you... how do you feel about all of... Well, they try and add a bit of drama in by having, you know... There's, like, a Russian guy who gets... killed because he helps Robert Redford and things. Well, Abby, how do you feel about
that scene?
That's just a bit that's lost to type because this still would have been post-Cold War. So he would have had more relevancy at the time than he does now.
But should a jokey LOL's Ocean's 11 before Ocean's 11 film be murdering people and making us feel sad for
spies? It has to have some sense of weight. That's the problem. Is it doesn't give us enough of that, and it goes a little bit too broad and silly on the humour. But when there is violence, it feels out of place. It feels overly shocking. It's not that it is violent, but I almost felt like I wanted more of that kind of scene rather than so much of the friendly dad jokes.
And also, like, it's got a bit of Bond stuff going on where, like, you got the Bond villain style thing where Ben Kingsley, explains that he got out of prison, he helped the mafia with their accounts, there's encoded stuff, and he wants this magic box because it's powerful. That's like any fantasy movie, he wants the magical power thing. But like he explains all this, and then he like dumps Robert Redford out somewhere, and it's all to get this contrivance that Robert Redford's been kept in a boot of a car, and has casually listened to the road,
Yeah,
and therefore
see,
they spend a fucking shit ton of time going, oh, of course, the roads. And then, like, Whistler's like, oh, what kind of road was it? Oh, it had this many bumps. It can't have been that bridge. Oh, again, there was the sound of, like, it was like we're in a fucking dinner party. Dinner party, you dickhead. It was geese or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Oh.
Well, that scene, though, on paper, sounds quite clever and that it could be fine. But again, like a lot of the other stuff in this film, it's so padded and long. And, I know what's coming because they give me long enough to already guess instead of being surprised by anything.
Yeah, it's implausible, but it's a movie, so of course they're going to do extraordinary things. Yeah. But wound me up all the time. Just the crapness of all their little revelations.
Him in the boot of the car feels like it just goes on for ages.
I mean, it has to, like,
why is it, like, I get it, he's in the boot of a car.
So we can tell where he is. We have to have the whole tedious journey so that we can cure it all.
I don't need to see the entire drive.
We need to cure the entire drive, though, so we can piece it all together ourselves. But, you know, that's all to figure out where, there's some fucking toy company that's a shell company that's where Ben Kingsley works from. And then they're setting up a big, like, I don't know, they're going to steal back, is that right? They're going to steal back the magical box? And then they have to do a kind of Mission Impossible Ocean's 11 style surveillance heist hack job.
Ben Kingsley in this, his character, like the adult version of Cosmo, the way he looks, the way he talks, his whole setup that he has, it all feels like the James Bond film between License to Kill and GoldenEye that was never made.
And it's, in fairness, like, if Bond was about five middle-aged or young men with different skills and abilities and didn't get in too much danger, that would be more plausible. So, you know, Sneakers is more grounded in that it's more feasible that they could have done this as a team.
It's what would happen if your dad who loves James Bond actually did get thrown into that kind of situation.
He'd fuck it up, but he would have done it with surveillance equipment and a bit of, you know, trial and error, beeping and booping with sticks and let me hear that sound again. Nah, there we go, you know.
High-waisted jeans.
Yeah. Sitting in vans, making jokes, filming things, getting caught easily by security.
Getting easily caught by security guards.
One of the major problems I had, so there's a whole hoo-ha, and we don't need to go into the details, I don't think, of how they do it, but essentially there's... Oh, we didn't mention the lady who's Robert Redford's sort of ex and has a past, but she's not interested until she is instantly interested in him again.
Yeah.
She goes along... They need an apartment to do this thing from, because I guess their HQ is compromised because they're all on the run. And so she's agrees to let them be in their apartment that they, I don't know, they fucking eat pizza and take out and do stuff
with computers and
pieces of paper.
It's like when the Ninja Turtles end up in April's apartment in the second one.
So, you know, she's in on it as well. So they use her to sort of, what's it called? Is it something fishing? Catfish.
Oh, catfishing, yeah. They catfish Stephen Tobolowsky.
Yeah, and they basically rummage through his recycling to find out he's a loser who goes on dates. And then there's a lot... And again, this is where it's padded again. So he goes on dates and they find out about him. And there's a lot of, oh, we will trick him into thinking it's a real relationship, as if, like, the hungry dog wouldn't eat just anything. You know, a woman is paying attention to you. It doesn't matter if you tick the right boxes or not. But
I was so extra infuriated when she shows up for that date and the first thing he does is goes to the dimsum bar on his own. Like,
I like his character. I mean, just because he's a good sort of comedy character actor, and he does do a good job of turning sinister suddenly whenever he figures out that she's not who she says.
He figures out that she's not who she says. I mean, it's too good to be true, but then he's invented a wind-up dog, like a robot dog that kicks over her purse and he finds her ID, because you always snoop in someone's bag when it's fallen over.
Yeah.
But, like, so there's a little, you know, shitty dog toy that helps out. and causes him again, to get all cross.
Whenever you said that about this dragon, it got to like they went out for dinner, and then they talked about breakfast and stuff, and then they were in his apartment, but it looked like it was night, and I was sitting there just thinking, did I tune out? Did I fall asleep?
Is this a rom-com about people who should, you know, like shouldn't be on a date?
Even more simply, I was just like, is this supposed to be the same day? What's happening?
Yeah. I think the breakfast line was supposed to be a pickup line.
Yeah, but...
like a really... but, yeah.
But, you know, she's on the date with him, so he's away from his office, so they can use his office, which is conveniently next door to the place where Ben Kingsley keeps his magic box out on a table, but with special motion sensors everywhere that are fallible if you don't move quick. Or are a ghost?
Well, the temperature has to be like body temperature throughout the room, and then if he moves slowly enough, it won't detect that difference in movement because it goes off the temperature reading as well as
whatever. Call me crazy, safe. That'll solve that problem. You know,
yeah, they could hack that though.
Well, they could hack into it with their beeps and boops, and you know, well. You know, the other thing is like in Mission Impossible, where it's like lasers everywhere. It's like, but there's still space to move in between. Just have an absolute grid of lasers, or just pay your security guards to do their fucking jobs.
I don't feel like you're going into the spirit of films.
When do I ever enter into the spirit of films?
Rich is doing his realism thing again.
There would be no films. Like, zero films if people made good decisions.
Okay, but hear me out. In terms of films, what is exciting? Okay, so, you know, Tom Cruise dangling from a rope, sweating, potentially setting off lasers. Exciting. A man slowly walking with a box.
Through a room.
Not a good film. Even in the world of films, not exciting.
I felt a similar thing when this thing was happening. It's like, well, this is just a really lame rip-off of Mission Impossible. But then you have to think, this is like 5 years before Mission Impossible. So that's it's kind of a harsh criticism. So I let it slide for that.
It's not ahead of Mission Impossible, the TV series. So I don't know if... I don't think that had lasers and dangling, but it had gadgets, shoe phones.
The whole setup with the slow walk across the room... It kind of sums up. It kind of sums up the problem because, on paper, there's a lot of ways you could make that funny or tense, but in the film, it just ends up making it even slower.
Yeah,
because everything around it is fucking slow as well.
Yeah, I mean, and then you know, so we got there's some drama. We got you know people sneaking in as gardeners or something, and using toilets. And there's lots of setup, and then they have the dramatic bit where the dramatic. Oh no, the guy's discovered she's a lying bitch, and he hasn't like shivved her with a knife. They go to his office, and there is the office next door. And Ben Kingsley's a bit weird here because even though it's not his, he's always like, oh, it's fine, and then there's oh shit, this is let's find out, and they go in, and oh nothing's wrong. I won't check my office.
Yeah.
Please let me,
because there's the moment coming up which totally lost me, just took me out of the film and just totally lost me from the whole thing altogether, was just after this scene where it's like, oh no, we haven't discovered anything. It must be fine. And then, like, Liz is leaving, and she says, like, well, that'll be my last computer date. First of all, the term computer date. and then secondly, like, Ben Kingsley turns around and is like, what? The computer matched you two? There's something amiss here. And it's like, that just took me right out of it, that moment.
But Anthony, you're like, entering no, into the spirit of films. Come on, no, that's how films work.
Up until that point, I was fine. I was going with it. I don't know what it was about that moment that just totally took me out of the film.
I was just going to say, it sounds fucking stupid.
Well, yeah.
I was going to say that I just got distracted from that moment by finding out that Ben Kingsley doesn't know how to run.
Oh, yeah! What the fuck was that? I'm glad someone else said that, because I didn't know what to make of it. He just sort of does there this some... weird prance thing.
I think it's because he had to rush, but it was over a short distance.
Yeah, it's not necessarily rush.
He's playing it's a nerd like, as well. They don't do exercise.
That's true. You know what it's like? It's like when someone holds a door open for you and you're slightly too far away to like justify them doing it. So you have to do that shitty sort of half-walk jog and then be like, oh, thanks. Mm. We both look weird. Mm.
But, you know, they're all caught out and they're about to be, Robert Redford's going to be killed. But luckily, he doesn't seem that worried because he knows he's got a chap who knows that when I say now, jump through the ceiling and attack the men you can't see with shotguns. There's two of them, so you get one, I'll get the other one. We'll be fine. So they manage to fight off these dudes. I think they get up to the rooftop, and at this point, the security guards swarm everyone basically, and they're. The guys who are watching, like, we got three, is it three of them? Like, Whistler, Arsecrack, and who else is in the van?
Whistler, Crease, and Mother.
They're in the van, and they're, like, arrested by the security guys. Except Whistler is, like, secretly hiding, but he's blind, so he can't drive a van, so he's not going to drive the van, right? But they're caught, and then Robert Redford and stuff, they're up on the roof, or Robert Redford is, with the MacGuffin-y magic box. And where is Ben Kingsley's security guards now? Like, they spent ages on the roof, and there's a little, like, you know, Ben Kingsley's got a gun on him, they're negotiating, Robert Redford pulls the old classic, I'm giving it to you, but I've secretly palmed it out, and I've given you a decoy. And obviously Ben Kingsley falls for that like a fucking schnook. Like, he doesn't check in the box or anything. So Robert Redford's on this roof, but there's no security anymore. They kind of give up, and Robert Redford's like, guys, you got to pick me up in the van, I'm escaping. And, you know, they've managed to convince the blind guy to drive the van. And it's just literally, he's up a hill a couple of car parks away, and... You know, the blind guy crashes the van down. It's really stupid. And, like, because the van drives off, the security guards have got them, like, arrested, sort of bungle it and let the guys go free. And by the time the van pulls up to pick up Robert Redford and his missus or whatever, the two other guys have ran down the hill after the blind guy anyway. So all this big rush to get in the van, let's make the blind guy drive. And we'll direct him. It's complete bullshit because A, no security guards turn up again. They've all clocked off because it was solved 5 minutes ago. And they can all just run. Like, if Robert Redford had just, no one's driving the van, I'll just jog to it quickly. It would have been.
And they also kind of ruin, like, the biggest joke setup as well of the film in that point.
Go on.
Because, like, right at the beginning, like, the two kind of fake NSA guys come in. And that they're talking about everyone's past. And, like, they mention that Sidney Poitier used to be in the CIA, but then was, like, let go. And they never say why.
Yeah.
And then later on, at this point, he says, like, did I ever tell you why, they fired me from the NSA? He was like, no. It was like, because of my temper. I was like, oh, that, you have waited so long for that joke. And that was your punchline, my temper. And then he just kind of like punches a guy. It's like that, come on.
It was Shades of Mean Machine. I've been here for drunken assault, bang! it was just, come on, guys. It was such a stupid, the whole bit was so stupid.
Yeah, they throw in some casual racism from one of the guards for no fucking reason as well.
Yeah, and there was a bit at the beginning where River Phoenix kind of blacks up.
That was quite funny, but more because of Sidney Poitier's fantastic facial expression when he sees.
Why are there these little weird kind of racist bits in there?
I don't remember this. Do like the security one of the guards call Bigaboo or something horrible?
You know, they call him Midnight, which is a
That sounds like a gladiator name from the TV show.
That is a gladiator name.
Was he a black guy? Were they racist? Yeah,
yes, I think he was. Yes.
Oh, well, that's not okay. But, like...
Oh, wait, was he?
Nightshade, I don't know. Someone. There are lots of names.
It's a very PG way to have, you know, racism in the film. But at the same time, you don't really need it. Like, there's enough...
No, that's the whole thing.
There's enough peril for this friendly dad film. You don't need to throw in racism.
Yeah, exactly. It felt like it was just there because they had Sidney Poitier. And it's like, well, what's that saying? It's like, why are you throwing in these weird kind of racist reference just because you have a black actor? It's like, a bit awkward.
I don't know. Could they have turned it on everyone and be like, oh, Mr. Magoobier or fucking Ghostbuster schlub? Fucking, I don't know. What could you... Wrinkle face and his and baby driver or whatever the little thing can become.
That's but that would be fine because that's not weirdly.
Yeah, it's the they place single the him is. Out. They single him out for an insult, and it's specifically a racist one.
Maybe they were brought up by Clint Eastwood from Gran Torino.
The other point, the problem with that is. What he then does in return isn't like the racism is way more than the rest of the film has been doing. So the fact that all he does is hit the guy, like I felt like it was setting it up. Well, gloves are off now. He's going to shoot the guy. No, just my temper. Hits him. And then it's never, nothing like that happens again.
Well, so Ben Kingsley goes away with the empty box. How do things resolve for him? Because
that's it. Like, there isn't a resolution.
That's it, yeah. He's just like...
Oh. There's a very bright light.
Yes.
There's a very bright light, which, I don't know, kind of suggests he's dead.
Or beamed up.
He's having a stroke.
So there's literally... Is he still on the loose or arrested or something?
It never comes up, and I kind of thought, well, if he's got all the means to do all of this, how is he not just going to immediately do it again?
Maybe it was setting up for a sequel, like Sneakers 2, Sneaking Again, Miami. Miami style.
Sneakers Night, like Sneakers
Night. Sneakers Midnight. Yeah, so I don't know, like, they in a weird... Well, you shouldn't have just glossed over this. You should actually elaborate.
Yeah,
but they don't. They just go, fuck it. Remember we made those drunken wishes about stuff? We're going to faff around with Darth Vader for a bit. Some comedy ending bullshit. Ooh.
Yeah, and it all just sort of really comfortably and conveniently ends.
Yeah, I got a bit confused because there was some establishing like who these bad guys were. They were like, oh, you're those pricks. No, those pricks are the FBI. Oh, you're the cunts. No, the cunts are CIA. We're the fucking BBC or IRS or like, we're the NSA or like whatever it was. And it's like, we're the good guys. We listen, we breathe down your phone call. I still don't know. And then what? So is the box eventually go to the FBI or what? What? Who's Jim Sil Jones? Is he CIA or
NSA?
They're the NSA.
Yeah,
and they're the real NSA.
And they, I guess, yeah.
But then the infuriating thing here is Robert Redford pulls the same con on the NSA by going, well, you know, this thing never really worked and it's broken and stuff. We don't care. As long as I get to leave this room with the box, I literally don't
as
care.
Long as this film gets to fucking end, we don't care.
And then Robert, like... and then they all go, but you know, they could still get it working and stuff, couldn't they? Not if I've got this bit of computer chip they can't.
Well, yeah, but they're going to kill you then.
Yes. So you...
They just bargained with you for ages in a really tedious scene, and it turns out you fucking conned them out of it.
Yeah,
they're going to...
The first computer guy comes and goes, oh, yeah, James Earl Jones, where's the important microchip we need to see if this works? Oh, that sneaky fuck.
That sneaky ginger bastard.
Execute them all, take the chip back.
Yeah,
snipers, bang, 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 bang.
Yeah, it's not like they don't have... The whole film is hinged on the idea that these vague agencies are able to track down these people who are just trying to muddle along. Yeah. And, like, the whole film has kind of based around that idea. And then he just fucks them over at the end like a fucking idiot. What's going to happen now? There's no...
Well, what's going to happen is a... news reader is going to come on, and he's going to go, "Oh, the bloody Republicans and people you don't like have lost lots of money, but these other places, these other charity and Greenpeace and things that you consider good have lots of money. Hooray!"
How convenient. The end. I'm like, fine.
So, Abby, are there bits you would have liked to have talked about, maybe we've glossed over, or you've not felt you've had a chance to mention?
Dan Aykroyd is the only person in this entire film who knows how to dance with a woman. That was a problem.
I mean, he was one of the Blues Brothers.
For his sins. Just be
Well, I guess I should talk about David Strathairn a little bit more, since he was sort of the reason that I picked it.
Because blind guys. What are you so interested in blind people for, Abby? I did ask you, but you just glossed over it.
I'm not sure I don't know what took me to the idea originally, but in retrospect, I think it's sort of just about... It's a very big deal when something's representative now, whereas in this, he was just a person in the team who happened to be blind, and that was a skill.
I do think they do a good job of using that without making it weird or insulting or exploitative or all the other myriad of things they could have done wrong.
It's very convenient the number of times hearing is a big part of it, because I imagine there's lots of bank jobs and con jobs that don't require you listening to bumps on the road or beeps and boops. Like, it's convenient for the film that he was so useful, but
I'd say also that sort of, like, if you think about something like The Conversation, Rich,
yeah,
that is literally just listening, more or less. So it's coming from that. It's closer to that era than our era.
Yeah,
so that might
true.
Be why it feels weird.
Yeah, I mean, The Conversation is fascinating and intriguing. It was a really good film. I'd be hard-pressed to find flaws with The Conversation. And you're right, there is something interesting about the world of technology, surveillance. Like, there's something to be enjoyed about the craftiness of coming up with schemes to con people. That's why, you know, Ocean's 11 was so successful and franchises like Mission Impossible are so watchable. It's because spies and espionage, it is fascinating. And it's nice to have a film representing schlubby, realistic-ish, like, slight, like, people with lame nicknames and, you know, crap clothes and, you know, who aren't... It's nice for a film to try and suggest that Hollywood movies can be about fairly normal people, but then at the same time it's very filmic and corny, so...
Yeah, that's the problem, is I appreciate that it's trying to put more of a deliberately mundane kind of spin on something that's often very over the top.
Yeah.
But it's just, it doesn't move away from the cheesiness of, you know, Hollywood dad comedy of the early 90s.
So is that really why you were interested in it? Because of, you know, what we're saying about the trying to be realistic when it comes to, you know, Hollywood action movie shit?
I think so, yeah. And it's more sort of, I feel like they're people, whereas in other films, like the kind of films that we've mentioned, those aren't actually people in them.
They're not flawed people, are they? They're not, like, you know.
Or if they are, it's very dramatic, you know, tortured hero flaws.
Yeah.
It's easier to root for the guys in sneakers because they're sort of supposed to be relatable underdogs. They're still, you know, there's an element of flawlessness to Robert Redford. I mean, sometimes it's just he's ordered a pizza at the right time, so he's got away with something. But fundamentally, he's so smug. Even when he's got a gun to him, he's like confident, and then you go, oh, "Fuck off." That's where the movie world creeps in.
Yeah.
Too much. I'd rather it try and be more tense and more real than it be, you know, filmic. The fact that it's trying to be a big Hollywood narrative with cons and heists and, you know, reveals and things, it sort of spoils what could have been a more grounded and interesting
thing. I also just think very similar things have come along and done it better since.
Yeah, but Sneakers was there first. Like, one of the things we realised is all the things we're complaining about have happened after Sneakers, so
Yeah, that's kind of the thing that I had when I finished watching the film is I kept going like, well, this is better. Well, this did it better. Well, this did it better. And it's like, well, of course it did, because they were released 5 to 10 years after this.
Yeah, that's true.
Has anyone seen The Sting with Robert Redford? He's like doing loads of cons in that. I feel like this is sort of his wheelhouse again. Oldest The Sting. Has anyone seen it?
No.
I have, but not recently enough to get into.
All I can remember is like it's a bit meh considering how beloved it is by the few people who have seen it. Apparently none of us. Properly.
Yeah, but anyway,
Anthony, you might have been saying something. Sorry.
No, that was just about it. It's hard for me to kind of see it in the context of when it first came out. It's like maybe it would have been a bit more impactful at the time.
Yeah, but maybe.
After 25 years or however long it's been, it just doesn't quite have the same resonance.
Are we at metaphor time, guys? I think we've all sort of summed up our feelings on it as we talked about it. Very early, we sort of put our cards on the table for how we felt. We all know that it felt long, dragged, and was a dad joke a bit too much. But, you know, does anyone have, like, a sneaker in mind? Like, I don't know. I think I go on that could be a sneaker metaphor. I think it's like a 90s expensive Reebok shoe. Like a proper on-brand, you know, made by kids in a sweatshop, fancy design Reebok. And, you know, Jerry Seinfeld might think they're very cool and all that. But when it comes to, like, it's all Hollywood and it's a little bit, like, to appeal to dads to get them out jogging because they've just noticed they're getting a bit bald and a bit flabby, so they want to go out jogging. So they buy an expensive Reebok trainer, and then you look at it and you go, yeah, but it's a bit lame, isn't it? Just don't wear something so flashy, and yet somehow it's just a dad trainer. Like, it's too flashy, you're trying to show off, and you look lame, you look like you're having a midlife crisis. So for me, it's a pair of fancy, state-of-the-art Reebok trainers from the 90s on a slightly too flabby dad with really high jeans, and I just think, oh, just wear a regular trainer, you're not a fucking Olympian, come on. That's how I feel about this film. Bit lame, midlife crisis.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that I was struggling, but that's mine. Very, very simple. It just feels like a midlife crisis.
But not by the cool diehard way. Or Taken or something.
No, see, to me, when you say Die Hard in midlife crisis, I think of the fourth one or the fifth one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not you know, the good ones.
Sure. But yeah, go on.
That's it. I really don't crisis. Like. Yeah, it's just a really kind of dull man's 2-hour midlife crisis.
He sits all his kids around and talks about his old days in high school where he used to hack computers, and they're just like asleep listening to him talk about floppy disks and
He stays up really late that night. He drinks like 2 more beers than he normally would, and he like watches a bunch of videos about what encryption is and how to hack stuff.
I could still go.
And then he like goes through all his accounts and like makes extra long passwords that he's going to forget the next day.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe you can enjoy an old fool indulging himself, but maybe you can't. Anyone else got one?
Oh, I'll see if I can hash it out. I don't think the film was like a total failure.
No.
Had its moments, like you said. It had its moments. It was too long, by far. The humour was lame. But I think it's saved slightly by the people in it. Like, they're there, they're putting the effort in, they're having fun, and that is where, like, kind of the magic of the film is, if there's any in there. So it's not the sneaker, per se, it's the person wearing it. I can't think of anything. Like, I think Rich kind of nailed it with yours. So I'll just say, like, this film is just a dad joke, but told by a kind of cool dad.
Yeah, he did do some of the braggadocious hacking in his youth. So some kudos, but at the same time.
But it's still a dad joke, and it can only get so far.
Yeah, it's very good. And everyone would cringe upon hearing it again.
Yeah.
Like the first time was okay.
Oh, God, not this one again.
Dad, you're not funny. It's just a sleepover. You don't have to come in and talk to us. Go away. Just because you bought the pizza doesn't entitle you to come and mouth off about it. Shaking nuts, dude.
That's a kind of a good one. It's like your dad on a sleepover. Like, he's been cool for the most night. You know, he's bought you pizza, he's bought you drinks, but then he just keeps going that little bit much. He keeps trying to be the cool dad and keeps trying to join in the conversation rather than just leave you alone.
Good job your mom isn't here. You wouldn't be having this kind of fun with her around. Yeah. She'd make her a bed. Yeah, we kind of want to go to bed now. Goodbye. Yeah, maybe. Abby, yourself. I feel like we didn't so much throw Sneakers under the bus as we did throw him up on a telephone wire to sort of tell people that this is where the drugs are at, or something. I got confused with literal Sneakers. We didn't murder the film under a bus. I feel like maybe we shoved it into a bus and it sort of fell down a bit. I don't think we were too much on it.
I very much associate the 1990s with games of Trivial Pursuit. And Trivial Pursuit has that same problem of, if you play it full to the end, that's like 9 hours of gaming. So you keep going until there's this collective sense of, we're done.
Look, we're never going to get history or religion. We've done entertainment and all the other easy wedges. These ones about geography and history, go fuck yourself, it's not happening. I don't know how many bloody witch wives of Henry VIII did what, but I don't care anymore. Is that what you mean? Like, just like, can drag on while you need that final wedge. And then you have to get to the fucking hub, and everyone forgets that that's another... It's not just enough to have all the wedges. Is that what you mean?
Well, what I was going to say is it also counts for the sort of bittiness of this, where it's individual pieces work, but doesn't always cohere together. And that's what Trivial Pursuit's like. It's like, if you've got a nice run of questions that, even if you don't get them right, you were in with a chance, and that makes you feel better. But then there's other moments where you get like three in a row that are just absolutely meaningless to you, and you just start to feel a bit bored and unhappy.
Yeah, that happens. Like, hour and 30 into this, and you're looking at each other going... Can we just look? You've got 4 seconds of the party.
Like, this film's fine, nearly over. I mean,
we get it. Like, come on, yeah.
And then it's all added to because the game of Trivial Pursuit is 25 years old and doesn't have any like modern questions.
Yeah, there's no political questions beyond like fucking Tony Blair. He's the hot new politician in town.
And it also accounts for us having like. We collectively agree on that, but we also had, like, I feel like I personally did slightly better in the game of Trivial Pursuit than I usually would. So I enjoyed it a little bit more, even though I know it's going on a bit too long. And then some of you are a bit like, you're getting a bit cheesed off. You haven't got the wedges you thought you might.
I think we're more just reminiscing about actual Trivial Pursuit games and less talking about the film Sneakers now. But I take your meaning. We're all a bit, you know, it's dated, it's a bit lame, it isn't terrible, but...
I feel like I've been unduly harsh on it. It's just that it's
easy,
frustrating.
It's easy to mock a middle-aged dad, and this is what the film is. So,
yeah.
Yeah. We love middle-aged dads, good on you, but also enough now. So let's put this podcast to bed before it gets too rowdy and gets all the head up on pop. And then we're going to put on Channel Bravo while the kids are sleeping and watch a bit of Sin City or something. might kick the old slippers off. Oh, now I'm relaxing. Might have half a beer.
I'm going to sit back and have a sigh and go, hi, Icy.
I remember when I was a kid. Oh. Yeah. So yeah, that was Sneakers, and we've done it. So go home, listener.
Okay, go away.
Go bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.